Again, all of us are still certainly being mispalo, and our thoughts and our tefilos are with the three boys and their families, and we hope that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should bring a Yeshua very, very soon, and there should be shalom for all of Am Yisrael, both in Eretz Yisrael and all over the world. This parsha, of course, the parsha's Kaira, the parsha of great, great machlokas, obviously. But one thing that's very interesting is pointed out by the Balei Musar. If you look at Korach's basic arguments, Korach is an egalitarian. Korach basically argues that there ought not to be authority. Everybody is holy. Everybody heard the Aseres Hadibros. Everybody heard Hashem speak to Am Yisrael. There's no reason why one person should be better than another person. Basically, it was the position of the anarchist. Who needs authority? Huey Long, who was a great American populist, famous governor of Louisiana, had a campaign saying, every man is a king. That was pre-feminist, now we would say every person is a king. Whatever it would be. I remember years ago, when the World Trade Organization created an international framework for trade agreements, and this allowed this organization to penalize and override individual nations' laws. So, one world government always raises suspicions, so there was a big group of anarchists who wanted to organize a demonstration against the World Trade Organization. But because they were anarchists, they just couldn't get organized. So the demonstration never took place. So on one hand, Korach argues for the abolition of authority. And yet, that is not how Moshe Rabbeinu responds to him. Korach says, don't you have enough kavod, being the tribe of Levi that Hashem has chosen, Hashem has separated, Hashem has given you so much importance, so much kavod. Why do you seek more kavod? Why do you need more? But wait a second. That wasn't Korach's argument. Korach was not arguing for more kavod. Korach was arguing for the abolition of hierarchical structure. Answer: Moshe saw through the inner motivating agenda that maybe even Korach was not fully aware of. And that is, Korach's innermost desire was not to make everybody equal. Korach's innermost desire is that he should be the boss instead of Moshe and Aaron. And this is a very important insight into revolutionaries. Revolutionaries often claim they want to overthrow the established order in order to establish justice, equality, right? The old French Revolution, liberté, égalité, right? Fraternité. But in reality, it's just a question of replacing one power structure by another power structure. Beware of people who talk about the equality of man, when in reality, they really just mean, I'm going to be the boss. And that is why Moshe Rabbeinu understood Rav Lachem B'nei Levi. And this was understood by Mrs. On Ben Peles, who Chazal say was a wise woman, right? On Ben Peles was an initial revolutionary, and he seemed to have gotten disengaged. And the Gemara says, his wife basically told him, why are you getting involved in this? If Moshe wins, you're nobody. And if Korach wins, you're a nobody. He says, you're going to be a nobody. Sometimes a wife has to be very tough. You're going to be a nobody no matter how this comes out. One can imagine, from a human perspective, that Own, kind of an anonymous fellow, got very excited. Yeah, I'm going to be a leader too. We're all equal. And he was going to take up the flag. But Mrs. Own was able to point out what was really going on. And what's interesting is, it's even possible that Korach himself was not fully aware of what was going on. A person can talk himself into all sorts of things. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky used to say that often when we're offended, when we're slighted, we like to say, it's not a matter of my personal offense, it's a matter of principle. Rav Yaakov says, when you hear the words, it's a matter of principle, it almost always is a matter of personal offense, which we like to abstract into a general cause. Somebody once came to Rav Yaakov and complained about something that was done to him that was an avla, it was an injustice. So Rav Yaakov said, why are you so upset? He says, well, I'm not upset because it's me, I'm upset because it's an avla. And people who do such things have to be given mussar, they have to be criticized, they have to be put into their place. And Rav Yaakov responded, the avla of which you are complaining about has been going on for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Have you ever been so upset when it happened to somebody else? Well, if you're not equally upset when it happens to somebody else, it is because it's personal. And don't pretend it's a matter of abstract principle. And this was the insight, of course, that Moshe Rabbeinu had, Rav Lechem B'nei Levi, and this was the insight that even Mrs. Own Ben Pelles had, in which she was able to save her husband from death by making him understand what was really going on. And in fact, this kind of dichotomy or even inconsistency in Korach's thinking can be seen from the Techeles. If you remember, Korach posed two mishalim to Moshe. Well, first of all, Korach was a tax reformer. Right? One thing Korach argued, according to the Medrash, was he was talking about the fact that so many things go to Kohanim and Levim, the first fruits and the Truma and the Miser and the first shearings. Basically, the effective tax rate was like the Tea Party in the United States. The effective tax rate was like 30%. Okay, that was one thing. But the other thing, he had two mishalim. One was the mashal, if a talis is totally blue, the color of techeles, do you have to have white tzitzis on a talis that's totally techeles? And Moshe Rabbein said, yes. You need techeles and you need lavan. You need the blue and you need the white. I'm not going to discuss b'zman hazeh. Have we rediscovered the techeles? That, of course, is a very controversial question. But when we knew exactly what the techeles was, we have to have the techeles and the lavan. So Korach ridiculed Moshe by basically saying, if one string of techeles is enough to do the mitzvah, then kal v'chomer if the whole talis is techeles. Now, what is his analogy? His analogy is that Techeles represents the connection to God. What does Rashi say? The Techeles resembles the sea, and the sea resembles the sky, and the sky resembles the Kisei HaKavod. So the Techeles represents that part of Am Yisrael that is connected to Hashem. Korach's argument is, we're all Techeles! We don't need Techeles and Lavan. We don't need the blue, which represents those who are connected to Hashem, and the white, that are those who receive from them. We are all techeles. Kala eda kulam kedoshim. We don't need special techeles. And by the same token, Korach argued, if a house is filled with svarim, sifrei Torah, do you need a little mezuzah in one corner of the house? Moshe said yes. The mezuzah is special, it's unique, it's designated. Once again, Korach's argument is, you don't need anything special. Gans Klal Yisrael, all of them, every Jew is a Sefer Torah, we don't need the mezuzah. Right? So his two mishalim are precisely directed to this idea. No be out. Rav Soloveitchik called this the common sense rebellion, the notion that every Jew can decide how Hashem wants to be served. We don't need anybody telling us, whether Gedolim, Rosh Hashivas, even Moshe Rabbeinu. We don't need Moshe Rabbeinu to tell us how to serve Hashem. In reality, though, the Techeles and love and dichotomy has another message. Because it is a lesson in humility. Because Techeles represents our kesher to the Kisei HaKavod. The Techeles is Daimel Liyam, and the Yam is Daimel LeRakia, and the Rakia is Daimel to the Kisei HaKavod, connection to Hashem. The Lavan represents how distant we are from Hashem. Now I know that scientifically white represents all colors, but in terms of what we see, it represents the absence of color. So if Techeles represents our potential connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Lavan represents how far we are from achieving that goal. Maybe that's why we don't have Techeles today, according to many opinions, because we're so far, we don't even have that little bit of Techeles. So when a Jew looks at Techeles and Lavan, a Jew sees two things. What I can become, and the fact that I'm not there yet. It is a lesson in how great my neshama is, but how much more I have to do in my life before I achieve that potential. Korach's fatal flaw was he understood the lesson of the Techeles, but he did not understand the lesson of the Lavan. He was cognizant of his greatness, and he was great, and we'll talk about that. But he was not aware of the humility and the need to understand. Meaning, that's why Korach Badavka made the mistake with respect to Lavan. He didn't understand the meaning of the white. The Techeles is our greatness and our connection with Hashem. The Lavan is our distance from Hashem. And simultaneously, a Jew has to be aware of how great and elevated they can become, but also how distant we are from Shleimus. The Avudram writes that this is actually the meaning of every bracha. In every bracha, we first refer to Hashem in the second person, which is very intimate, Baruch Atah, as if Hashem is standing right next to me. And I can talk to him like a friend. I can talk to him like an intimate, like a confidant. But then we switch to third person. Shehakol niya bidvaro. Everything came into being by his word. Now if I say Baruch Atah Hashem, I should say Shehakol niya bidvarecha. Why bidvaro? So the Avudram says that every nusach of a bracha represents the two ways we relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. One is with closeness, with intimacy, with love. And the other is with yira, pachat, and mora. The lavan, and that's third party, distance, concealment. The lavan represents the concealment of God. The fact that we have awe and reverence and yira and how dare I approach Hashem. The Techeles represents the closeness to Hashem. Korach understood Techeles. He did not understand Lavan. And that's why Korach argued, a talis that's all Techeles doesn't need any Lavan. Now one other horror about Techeles, which is not directly connected to this parsha, that is the Bali Musar asked a good interesting question. Why don't Chazal just say, I look at the Techeles, and I think about the Sapphire Throne, I think about the Kisei HaKavod. Why do I have to go through steps? Techeles resembles the Yam. And the Yam resembles the Rakia. The Rakia resembles the Kisei HaKavod. Just say, the Techeles resembles the Sapphire Kisei HaKavod of the Almighty. Why go through intermediate steps? And there's an important lesson here. That is, spiritual growth must occur gradually and incrementally. You don't go straight to the Kisei HaKavod. You don't take an express elevator to be connected to God's celestial throne. You go through small incremental steps. Rav Yisrael Salanter used to say, I think I've mentioned it before, that every person might want to finish Shas in their lifetime. Again, men, women, that's a separate issue, but let's say, I don't want to take sides on that. So I'll say every person may want to finish Shas in their lifetime. And that's certainly an attainable goal. Baruch Hashem, person should try to do that. But then we say, every person would like to finish Shas in one night. That's very hard. Maybe the Vilna Gaon could do it. But then, somebody wants to finish Shas in one night and get 8 hours of sleep the same night. Rav Shlomo Salanter says, maybe even the Vilna Gaon. Of course, the Vilna Gaon never slept more than 2 hours. But 8 hours of sleep and finish us in one night doesn't work. But we want instant enlightenment, instant spirituality. We want to wake up and just be a tzaddik without recognizing that life is a gradual process of becoming, built with small steps, small daily incremental journeys. And eventually, as a person accumulates, a person develops in different ways. Impatience is a great vice of our society. I remember the first time I got a fax machine. It was a long time ago already. And I had to send a fax to China. And it took around 3 minutes. And I was very impatient. I was thinking, what is taking so long from Baltimore to China? You know? And I was upset. I was upset. Why is it taking so long? And yet, you know, I remember when I was a kid learning about the War of 1812. And Andrew Jackson, who became president of the United States, was a very successful general. And he won a medal for a decisive battle against the British, the Battle of New Orleans. And he won a medal for it, a medal of honor. But the problem is, the Battle of New Orleans was fought 3 weeks after a peace treaty had been signed in Europe, because it took that amount of time. This is before there were telegraphs to get across. So, on one hand, a war goes on for 3 weeks. How many people died in those 3 weeks because they couldn't communicate? And yet, 3 minutes was too much to wait to get my fax over to China. So all of us are impatient. We're impatient in every part of our lives. But even in Ruchnius, we're impatient. We want to have instant understanding. The lesson of Chazal's imagery of Techelas is, you gotta be gradual. And you have to integrate in accordance with your spiritual panemius, not to externally do things that are not really reflective of where you are. In fact, there's a very interesting Gemara. The Gemara talks about a certain Amora who admired his father. He was talking about how great his father was. Because he says, when I eat fleishiks, I wait 6 hours before I have milchiks. But my father used to wait 24 hours. He was such a tzaddik, he waited 24 hours. So here's the thing. If the son really admired the fact that his father waited 24 hours, certainly the son could have waited 24 hours too. I mean, he had to have his Haagen-Dazs or Ben & Jerry's. I mean, if he thought it was worthy of emulation, why didn't he do it? I mean, this is not an impossible thing to do. Yes, it's inconvenient, and for us maybe it would be extremely difficult. But for an Amora, it wouldn't have been that difficult. But here's the answer. There's something very deep and very profound here. And that is, his father waited 24 hours because his father's Yiras Shamayim was so great that he was literally shaking. If Chas V'Shalom, there might be a particle of meat between my teeth or in my throat that would come in contact with milk, I just can't allow it to happen. Now, the son is basically saying, you know, I don't feel that way. So I could keep 24 hours, but it wouldn't be a reflection of any inherent Yiras Shamayim I have. It would just be imitating a chumra. And therefore, there was no spiritual benefit to that, because it would not have been a chumra that would have been reflective of my Yiras Shamayim. It would have been an external imitation, which he certainly could have done, but it wouldn't have had that spiritual meaning. My father did it because he was afraid of milchiks and fleishiks. Even after 6 hours, even within 24 hours, they would come in contact. I don't have that pachat. So for me, the chumrah would just be superficial. This is actually an interesting point in terms of when you adopt chumras, when you adopt hanhagas. It has to be reflective of a yiras shamayim that you have. Okay. But that's a separate point about gradualism. But in terms of Korach, the point I wanted to bring out is Techeles is our greatness, and Lavan is our void. And Korach was well aware of greatness. He didn't understand the void. In this connection, the Shem Mishmuel, great Hasidisha Sefer, for those who are familiar with names and the like. He was the son of the Avnei Nezer, the Sacharchever, was also one of the great Gedolei Hador, who in turn was the Kutzker Rebbe's son-in-law. So the Shemesh Shmuel was the Kutzker Rebbe's grandson. The Shemesh Shmuel brings the name of the Arizal, a fascinating gematria, but doesn't explain it. The Shemesh Shmuel explains it. The Ari does not explain it. And the Arizal says the following. The gematria of Moshe is 345. The gematria of Korach is 308. And the gematria of Hevel, Cain's brother, Hevel, that was killed, is 37. So if you're following the numbers here, 308 plus 37 equals 345. And therefore, Moshe equals Korach plus Hevel. Or, expressed differently, Moshe minus Hevel equals Korach. Right? So you can either say Moshe minus Hevel equals Korach, or Korach plus Moshe, Korach plus Hevel equals Moshe. Right? This is what the Arizal writes, but he doesn't really explain it. So the Shemesh Shmuel offers a beautiful, lengthy explanation. And he basically says, with the premise, which is brought down in other Sfarim as well, that Korach and Moshe are Gilgulim. They are reincarnations. Korach is a reincarnation of Kayin, and Moshe, Rabbeinu, is a reincarnation of Hevel. And in a sense, the outcome of the story is a role reversal. Instead of Kayin killing Hevel, Hevel gets to kill Kayin. So in one sense, Kayin's sin gets atoned by the death of Korach. But in a much more deeper way, there's a reason why the neshama of Moshe is mechubar to Hevel, and the neshama of Korach is mechubar to Kayin. Chava named their son Kayin, let's say Kayin, because she called him Karnisi Ish Es Hashem. And many people mistranslate that pasuk, because we're used to in modern Hebrew, Kanisi, and even in rabbinic Hebrew, even in the Gemara, Kanisi means I have acquired a man or a son through Hashem, Lashon Kinyan. And that's how I believe that even the standard English translations will say I have acquired a child, a man, through Hashem. But actually, Kanisi does not mean acquired, at least like many commentaries. Konisi means I have created. When we say Avram talks about HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Kone Shamayim Ba'aretz, it does not mean God acquires heaven and earth. It means God creates heaven and earth. So Konisi-ish means I have created a person. So the Shemesh Shmuel explains that Kayin represents the power within the human being to create, to innovate, to build. That Kayin is the source of all progress in the world, in which mankind has ambition. Man wants to say, man, I mean human beings, they want to create, they want to build, they want to exercise their autonomy, their intelligence, their bechira, whether it's science, technology, and the like. Even the idea of a korban, fascinatingly enough, although there's some midrashim that say Adam HaRishon brought korbanos, but lefi pshuto shel mikra, the first person who innovated the idea of bringing a korban to Hashem was not Hevel, it was Kayin. Now Kayin did it poorly, and Kayin did not do his best, but it was Kayin who was machadesh the idea of korban, and all Hevel did was improve upon Kayin's idea. So Kayin is creativity. Kayin is innovation. Kayin is initiative. Kayin is autonomy. Very, very positive. The downside of that aspect of Kayin, it turns into gaiva, arrogance, hubris. Now Hevel is the opposite. The very word Hevel Right? Remember Shlomo HaMelech when he describes how futile and useless this physical world is. He says over and over again in Koheles, Havel Havalim Amar Koheles. Now in English it's translated vanity, but again I do want to point out a little point that I'm sure that you know over the years. Vanity today tends to be pride, persons, right? But in the when the King James Version was translated in the 16th century, vanity really meant futility. Hevel does not connote pride. Hevel connotes even by Eish Yisrael, Hevel Hayofi. Hevel means like breath, something that just vanishes. It has no permanence. It has no right. So the truth of the matter is, the modern English word or the modern English usage of vanity does not correspond with Hevel. Hevel is closer to futility, something ethereal, something temporary, something that doesn't last. So the sheirish of Hevel is humility and submission to the Ribono Shel Olam. And that's a wonderful thing. But the downside of the Midah of Hevel is you become passive and paralyzed, in which you feel you're so unworthy that you're not capable of accomplishing things in this world. And that is actually why it was Kayin that was Mechadish Korbanos. Because from a Hevel perspective, you actually think, who am I to bring a Korban to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Who do I think I am? Lifnei Melech Malchei Amlachim, I bring a Korban? Only when he sees that Kayin did it, and apparently HaKadosh Baruch Hu liked the idea, even though Kayin's Korban wasn't so good, does Hevel then jump on the bandwagon and even does it better. But Hevel Mitzad Atzmo would not have come up with the idea of a Korban. Because the Midah of Hevel says, I'm unworthy to approach Hashem. Rav Soloveitchik used to say quite often that if Hashem wouldn't have commanded us to daven to Him, we would not have been allowed to daven to Him. Because to daven to Hashem is such a chutzpah. Who do you think you are? Who do we think we are to dare to ask Hashem for anything? It's a point. On one hand, Hashem loves our tefillos. Hashem yearns for our tefillos. But that's only because He told us to daven to Him. Meaning, had He not told us, we wouldn't have been allowed to daven to Him. What type of chutzpah is that? Same thing with Hevel. Hevel would not have imagined you could bring a korban to Hashem. So do you see what is going on here? The shayrish of Kayin represents that power within the human being to create, to innovate, to take initiative, to take responsibility. Whether it's, and that's why it says that indeed Kayin built cities. Although he had to wander, right? He built cities. Kayin represents progress, initiative, and creativity. Hevel represents submission and humility. Kayin's creativity, his self-worth, his inflated self-worth, turned into something that was destructive and murderous. And therefore his neshama needed a tikkun. Hevel's great humility turned into passivity, and that needed a tikkun. So Gilgal, the doctrine of Gilgal, which by the way I do want to emphasize, Gilgal is not mentioned in the Gemara, so it's not clear. If you were to ask me, do we have definitive proof from Chazal in the Gemara or the Medrash that there is such an idea as reincarnation? The answer is we do not. We do not. Gilgal was an idea that was developed by the early Mekubalim, but very early, even before the Arizal. The Ramban, for example, talks about Gilgal as one of the reasons why righteous people suffer. One of the answers, so to speak, of tzaddik v'ralo is that one is getting punished or one is getting an atonement for sins that were created in a prior Gilgal. Okay, so when people always ask me, again, and for some reason, boys in Or Sameach are obsessed with Gilgal. They love to talk about it all the time. And they hear that if one doesn't believe in Gilgal, they're an apikarsa, doesn't have a share in the world to come. That wouldn't be shaykh, really, because if it's not mentioned in Chazal, we do not treat it as an article of faith. Nevertheless, the Mekubalim do teach us this idea, and therefore we generally do accept it as true. Yeah.
What is the dating of the Sefer
Gulim? Well, Sefer Gulim is from Rav Chaim Vital. So it's after the Arizal. But the earliest mention I'm aware of, and there might be earlier ones, is Ramban in his Perish Te'iv, which is the 12th, which is the 1100s. So that is much earlier than Sefer HaGilgulim. Yeah.
How do you find
Bachayim? That's for sure. We certainly believe that at the end of the Messianic era, Hashem is going to revive the dead and we will come back. No, that's for sure. No one's arguing with that. That is one of the 13 principles of faith, that there will be resurrection of the dead. What is a little more controversial is whether there'll be a constant reincarnation in which my neshama will go through many, many lives until I rectify and do my mission. That, I was suggesting, does not have a clear source in the Gemara, but still, the great Mekubalim did say it, and we therefore accept it as true. So Korach and Moshe come back. Korach's goal is to be Mesaken Kayin. Now, Korach, in many ways, we have to remember, had enormous talents. Korach's understanding of Torah was phenomenally deep. According to one Medrash, he penetrated the secret of Para Aduma. He just understood the secret of Para Aduma. Korach was, of course, the ancestor of the Navi Shmuel. Because remember, the Bnei Korach did not die, and eventually, in fact, we have many Kapitlech Tehillim. Lam Natseach, Livnei Korach, and yeah, that is that Korach. That's not some Korach. These are the descendants of Korach. And we know that Shmuel himself was considered to be as great as Moshe and Aaron. So Korach figured, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. If I'm going to have a great-great-grandson like Shmuel, it's all coming from me. That's how he interpreted it, that it was his greatness. So Korach was phenomenally great. He had all of the positive attributes of Kayin. The tikkun would have been had he combined it with humility. He did not, so in a sense, failed again. So Korach did not have his ultimate tikkun. But what the Gematria is suggesting is the following. Hevel, what was the chisarin within Hevel? Passivity, paralysis. So what happened? Moshe Rabbeinu generally is described as the Anav Mikol Adam, the most humble of all people. He had the qualities of Hevel. And yet, in spite of his anivus, he was the manig of Am Yisrael. He took us out of Mitzrayim. Kriyas Yamsuf. He led us in the Midbar. Moshe did not allow his anava to paralyze him. But rather, Moshe Rabbeinu understood that true modesty, true humility, does not mean you think of yourself as a nobody, but you recognize that if Hashem gave you kochos, they are really what Hashem gave you. They're not from you, and you must use them in the service of Hashem. So you see, Moshe is a 100% tikkun for Hevel, because Moshe Rabbeinu took the qualities of Hevel and he combined them with the good qualities of Kayin and was able to do what he had to do. So the Shema Shmuel tells us, after this long hakdama, the Shema Shmuel says, this is the meaning of the Gematria. Korach is everything Moshe is, minus the quality of Hevel. Moshe is Korach plus the quality of Hevel. Seen in this way, we can look at the story of Korach as a tragedy, and forgive my mixing nationalities here, a tragedy in the Greek sense, right? The famous Greek understanding of tragedy is not when something external happens to you, but when there's a flaw within that destroys such a magnificent potential. The ultimate tragedy of Korach was not that the earth opened up. that's kind of just the end of the story. The ultimate tragedy of Korach is, according to the Arizal, that here you have a person with all of the potential greatness of a Moshe Rabbeinu, but because he lacked the humility of a Hevel, because he had that gaiva, because he had that kavod, he was destroyed from within. And that's always a much, much tragic thing when a great person gets destroyed. If a person wouldn't have had all those great milas, so it would have been a sad thing, but it wouldn't have been a tragic thing. When greatness gets destroyed because of a pagam in the midah, that is tragedy. Right? That is tragedy. And Korach was a great, great tragedy. Because everything Korach thought was really correct, that he indeed is the ancestor of Shmuel, he understood Parah Aduma. Even the statement, Kol Ha'eda Kulam Kedoshim, all of that is true as well. But in the gaiva of not being willing to submit to Moshe Rabbeinu as the Adon HaNeviim, and his desire to have that leadership and that authority, everything was destroyed. And the Alter Slobodka used to say all the time that when a person is consumed with kavod, everything gets destroyed. He says there's no Tisha B'Av, there's no Yom Kippur. In the middle of Yom Kippur, again, these are, you know, a person might start screaming because a certain kavod was not given to him. What do they tell the story? They tell the story about a person who, during Musaf, when the Chazan was saying, Adam Yesodo Me'ofer, remember after Nisan HaTokef, very, very emotional part of the davening. So the end of the piyut says, Adam Yesodai Me'afar, the human being's foundation is dust. V'saifai Le'afar, and at the end of their life they shall go back to dust. Moshul, he is compared to Cheres HaNishbar, like a piece of broken pottery, like a dried flower, like a weed, like a dream that flies away. And then it ends with this, the words, but yet, tshuva, tfila, and staka, ma'virin es roa hagisera, then gives us hope. Now, there was a person who was davening, and he was, as these words were being said, he was sobbing, he was crying, and the Rav couldn't help but notice, and the Rav was very impressed. I didn't realize this person was such a tzaddik. I have to pay attention to him during the year. So then, it was mincha time, Yom Kippur, and they called up somebody from after Yonah, which is a big honor, and they didn't call up this guy. So this guy starts yelling in the middle of mincha, you know, how do you give him, you know, I'm such a greater person. So these things actually do happen sometimes. So the Rav waited till after Yom Kippur, went over to the person and said, you know, I noticed during Musaf, you know, how much kavanah you had, and we talked about how lowly man is, and I really was moved, and it gave me his sorrowers also. So I just don't understand what happened at Mincha. Why were you so upset? So he says, Rebbe, it's not a kasha. When I'm talking to Hashem, I'm a nothing. But compared to him, you know, who does he think he is? You know, so that's what kavod is, right? Kavod can really destroy everything. And that's what the Alter Rebbe Slobodka said. With kavod, there is no Yom Kippur, there is no Tisha B'Av, there's nothing. Everything gets destroyed. Now, what is the opposite of this idea of kavod? So the opposite of the idea is a certain hashkafa in life where you become what you might call a task-oriented person as opposed to a personality-oriented person. And that is, in life there are things to be done. We have mitzvahs to do, chesed to accomplish. And when a person lives with the idea that Hashem has so many things we need to do in the world, you try to care less about who gets credit and focus more on the job that needs to be done. Ad kedei kach, that the Chazon Ish writes, and this is a mashal some people disagree with, it's an interesting thought experiment. The Chazon Ish pointed out that very often, even when we do chesed and kindness to others, a large part of the motivation is it builds up our ego. It makes us either have other people look at us and think how great we are, or even for ourselves, you know, it makes us think, yeah, I'm a wonderful person. And the Chazon Ish gave this thought experiment to try to prove the point. Now again, you might argue with the mashal, so something just to think about. He says, let's say that you're a person who really loves to have orchim on Shabbos. And after davening every Friday night or every Shabbos morning, you know, you look for the person who doesn't seem to have a place to go, a single, unattached, and you invite them and you have them over and everything is wonderful. So let's say one Shabbos the pickings are slim. It seems to be like everybody was taken, and you're looking around and you're very nervous, and then you see somebody, Baruch Hashem, and you zoom in for the catch, and the person tells you, "Oh, I know, I really would have liked to go to your house, but 5 minutes ago, so and so invited me." So the Chazon Ish says, "Do you feel good or do you feel bad?" So this is what he says. Now this is a difficult standard. If your concern was, I don't want a person not to have a comfortable place to be for Shabbos. I want them to be taken care of. I want them to be nurtured. I want them to get to meet people. Assuming that the other home is just as good, let's say. So the Chazon Ish says, it should almost be a matter of indifference if it's you or somebody else. Because your joy in life is that a person is being taken care of. And I'm just as happy if it's me than it's somebody else. If, on the other hand, there's like the ego involved, then you want it to be you. Right? Now, some people think the Chazon Ish is being maybe a little too strict on people because, after all, it is appropriate that I should have a joy in doing a mitzvah. It doesn't always mean egotism, but the Chazon Ish says, at least it's something to think about. Because when it comes to chesed, the ikar is not that I'm doing chesed. The ikar is that person gets what they need. And if they get what they need, I'm just as happy. Baruch Hashem, you know, you're taken care of. Baruch Hashem that you're with a warm family. And that should make me equally happy. In many ways, with all mitzvahs, it's that way. People are learning, people are building yeshivas, people are doing stucca. I should be happy. And I remember, interestingly enough, I remember when my son was in first grade, and so they would give a prize to the best student or the Shabbos Abba or whatever, I don't even remember. So he once came home, he was really, really excited. And he was so excited because he told me that one of his friends was Shabbos Abba or something. So, since I was already a corrupted adult, I was thinking to myself, gee, you didn't get it, why are you happy, you know? But the point was, he was as happy that a friend got it as if he himself got it. Meaning that absence of jealousy in which somebody else's simcha is my simcha. Because it doesn't have to be about me. And you see, this is the common denominator, by the way, between a Baal Gaiva and a person with low self-esteem. They're actually very close on the spectrum. Because both the Baal Gaiva and the person who thinks of themselves very poorly, they look at everything as a referendum about them. So when they do something good, I'm great. And when they mess up, I'm bad. A humble person doesn't think in those terms at all. They don't think they're great when they do good things. And they don't think they're bad when they're not successful. They simply ask the question, has the Ratzon Hashem been done in this world? And if it has, I'm happy. I'm happy if I did it, and I'm happy if somebody else did it. And when the Ratzon Hashem is not done in the world, I'm sad. I'm sad when I didn't do it, and I'm sad if somebody else didn't do it. Because I live my life so that the will of Hashem be done in the world. And that is what gives me, again, this is a madrega, that is what gives me joy. That is what gives me happiness. It is not about me. It is not a referendum about me. That's why Rabbanim of Prisiska once said an amazing vort. If you were given a choice, he said about himself, if he was given a choice to switch places with Avraham Avinu, that he would be Avraham Avinu, he said he would have no reason to make that switch. Because what does Hashem get out of the deal? If he would simply switch if the choice would be, there could be two Avraham Avinus, so Baruch Hashem would get a lot out of that deal. But, right now, there's one Avraham and there's one Rabbunim. So if instead of being the Rabbunim, I become the Avraham, and Avram becomes the Rabbanim, Hashem's net profit is zero. There's still one Avram and one Rabbanim. The only one who gains is me. Well, is that why am I serving Hashem? So I should be in a better position? So he actually said, I would not accept changing places with some greater tzaddik, because the Eibishter gets no revach from that type of switch. It's very that's a fascinating thing. But if you're in it for yourself, yeah, sure, I'd love to be in that better position, more olam haba, and everything else. And this, of course, is a very, very famous vort from the Chafetz Chaim, from the son of the Chafetz Chaim, that after the Chafetz Chaim was nifter, so they asked the Chafetz Chaim's son, Rav Leib, Rav Aryeh Leib, was a great Talmud Chacham. You know, Chazal say, Tzadik gozer, V'Kadosh Baruch Hu Mekayim, that Tzadik decrees and Hashem listens to the Tzadik. Can you give us stories how your father decreed things and HaKadosh Baruch Hu listened? Miracles. So Rav Leib said, I'm sure there are many stories of Tzadik Gezer, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mekayim, but my father was much more interested in HaKadosh Baruch Hu Gozer V'Tzadik Mekayim. My father was not interested in telling Hashem what to do. He was interested in doing what Hashem told him to do. So instead of focusing on Tzadik Gezer, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mekayim, we should focus on HaKadosh Baruch Hu Gozer V'Tzadik Mekayim. And that's really, much easier said than done, I understand. But I actually have two secular quotes here that I think fit. Both of them are from U.S. presidents. Again, I don't have a compendium of Israeli presidential quotes. Although, you know, the new guy is interesting. The new guy, Rivlin, is a direct descendant, I'm sure. You know, the Rivlin Mishpacha were the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, who came to Eretz Yisrael, and as a result, he does have a very, very chashuv yichus, and hopefully it'll be a little bit positive, although I know that the Prime Minister is not so friendly with him, for whatever reason. I don't even know why, but that's right. He remarked that his wife is not involved in politics, and apparently Sarah Netanyahu was offended by the implication, something like that. But one quote is Ronald Reagan, and again, I'm not endorsing any policies, but Ronald Reagan once said, there is no end to the good that could be accomplished in the world if people wouldn't care who got the credit for it. And that's a very good one. Ronald Reagan. So, yeah. Chachma Bagayim Tamin, so we can mention. And the other is from Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was, again, a very unusual person. And he was in a cabinet meeting during the Civil War. And in the cabinet meeting, people were talking about how you have to fight the South. And so somebody said, Mr. President, we shall surely be victorious, for God is on our side. And Lincoln said, it's much more important for me that I be on the side of God than God be on my side. Meaning, the idea of living a life of devotion to Hashem is not that you enlist Hashem to do whatever it is you want. But it's the other way, that all the decisions you make are the decisions that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to make. And here I'll end with another. I said, Lincoln's your side? No, it isn't. I don't know why Lincoln's stories are coming to me. But I'll tell you another story about Lincoln, which is really Mamish Musar. Mamish is a Musar story. It really is a great, great Musar story. And this is, at one point in the Civil War, he had to fire a general or reassign a general who he felt wasn't doing his job well. But this general was a hush of a guy. He was like General MacArthur, and Truman had to fire MacArthur. And in those days, so Lincoln actually had to go. The guy refused to go to the White House. So Lincoln had to go to the guy's house in Northern Virginia. So he got the President of the United States goes to the guy's house. And the guy keeps him waiting 3 hours. The guy's taking a bath, and he's eating dinner. He can't be disturbed. And Lincoln is with one, he has a secretary, a male secretary with him. And Lincoln is waiting in the sitting room for 3 hours. My president. So at some point the secretary says, Mr. President, this is a bizarre, what type of, he didn't use the Hebrew words, what type of covet is this, this guy, just fire him and leave. So Lincoln says, life is too short to let these grudges consume you. There is so much we have to do. He says, we have a war. We have a country. You know, he says, I can't let it bother me. I just can't let it bother me. I get distracted. It just takes me away from what I have to do. This is the great mafteach of life. We get so distracted. Grudges, kavod, angry, fights. And at the moment it seems so powerful and so strong, and we have such strong, strong feelings. But putting aside the technical averas of lo sika, there are no technical averas. But in a more cosmic sense, it just takes away our life. It just wastes our life. It just takes us away from what we're able to accomplish. And if we could just have that perspective of focusing on the task and not focusing on us, there's so much that we would be able to accomplish in the world. And really, once again, that is the opposite of the Korach, where Korach, who was so consumed with kavod, in spite of his greatness, Korach got destroyed. And the opposite of that is to not put ourselves down, chas v'shalom, the other way around. Not to get inflated and not to get deflated. Simply focus on what is the Ratzon Hashem in this moment. Don't get distracted. Don't allow these things to consume us. Because ultimately, we just won't be able to do what we have to do. And Hashem put us in this world to do the good that we're able to. So, Be'ezras Hashem, I hope that all of us will be Zocha to free ourselves from these things that drag us down. And in that Zuchus, may we be Zocha to a Yeshua Hashem for the immediate Tzoras that we face, the three boys and Tzoras, and to ultimately a Geulah Shleima b'mehera v'yameinu.